The Sermon on the Mount comes in Matthew chapters 5 through 7, and this is really the kingdom introduction that Jesus gives. He lays down the basic groundwork of the new covenant. Just as the Ten Commandments were the foundation of the Law of Moses, in many ways the Sermon on the Mount serves as the foundation of the whole gospel of Christ. And we're actually going to pick up in the very last part of the sermon by looking at one of probably the more famous parts of it, where Jesus talks about building your house on the rock. So what I'd like to do this morning is I would like for us to go into this sermon and actually ask the question, what does it mean to build our house on the rock? So again, let's look at Matthew chapter 7, and we're going to go into this text together and really seek to understand what does it mean to build our house on the rock. Let's go ahead and read the text. Matthew 7, verse 24. Everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came down, and the winds blew and beat on the house, and it did not fall, because it had been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who has built his house on the sand. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat against the house, and it fell, and great was the fall of it. So you'll notice what Jesus says here is he gives a contrast between two different houses. Now, Jesus is the master of metaphor, and he uses this metaphor of the house to make a deep spiritual principle. You'll notice the first house that he talks about is the house built on the rock. I am so tempted to sing the song this morning, but I'm not going to do it. But you know, the wise man built his house on the rock. The wise man built his house on the rock. The winds came down. What happened to the house? It stood firm. That's right. It stood firm. Look, Matthew 4:24. Everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell and the floods came down and the winds blew and beat the house. That part's not in the song. But it did not fall, because it had been founded on the rock. Very simple, right? Here you have a house with a good foundation. It's on the rock. So a storm comes, the house stands. Good house. This is contrasted, of course, with a house on the sand. Verse 26. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like the foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rain fell, the floods came down, the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell, and the house went splat. That's what happens to the second house, right? Now, what's the difference between these two houses is the question that Jesus is really getting us to think about. Now, when you look at this, a real contrast here between the two houses, Jesus says nothing about the building material. He says nothing about layout plans. He says nothing about the nails that were used. He says nothing about the roof that's on it. He says nothing about how many stories it has. Says nothing about the geographical location, other than the difference of its foundation. One is built on a rock, the other is built on sand. To really understand what Jesus is getting at in this contrast, I think on the base level, it's very easy to understand what Jesus is saying. Have a good foundation. Be founded on Christ, you'll do well. Be founded on this world, you'll fail. That's, I think, on the surface, what this story is getting at. But I think Jesus is getting at something deeper here. And I think if we go back to the Old Testament real roots of this story, and then understand how one of the epistles uses this story in practice, we're going to understand on another level what this contrast of houses is really about. So look at Matthew 4:24 with me. Everyone who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. Now think through that with me just for a second. If you have just a good knowledge of the Old Testament, who is the wise man who built his house on the rock? Who is the wise man who built his house on the rock? Solomon. I think what Jesus is doing here is he's alluding back to Solomon. Again, he is the wise man who builds his house on the rock. This has to be referential to Solomon. So let's go back and let's look at a few Old Testament verses that demonstrate for us what this is really getting at. So as you go throughout the Old Testament, there's various times that David and Solomon in the Psalms talk about a house built on the rock. Let's look first of all at 2 Samuel. I want us to go to 2 Samuel chapter 22. 2 Samuel chapter 22. We prayed this together Friday night. This is David really giving a great psalm of praise to God for deliverance. I think David would have prayed this many times in his life. But notice how David calls God. We're in 2 Samuel 22. This is in Psalm 18, by the way. There's a repetition of this in Psalm 18. But let's look at 2 Samuel 22, verse 1. And David spoke to the Lord, and the words of the song on the day when the Lord delivered him from the hand of his enemies and from the hand of Saul. David said, "The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, my rock in whom I take refuge, my shield, the horn of my salvation, my stronghold, my refuge, my Savior. You save me from violence. I call upon the Lord, who is worthy to be praised, and I am saved from my enemies." Look down to verse 32. Same chapter, verse 32. "For who is God but the Lord? And who is a rock except our God?" Verse 47. "The Lord lives, and blessed be my rock, and exalted be my God, the rock of my salvation." Do you notice the repetition in this prayer, this psalm that's written in 2 Samuel 22? What David recognizes is this. Through analogy, he claims the Lord is the rock. What does that mean? The Lord is the rock. So if you look at verse 2, "The Lord is my rock and my fortress." Normally in our colloquial, if you call someone a rock, that's not a compliment. Poor Charlie Brown. Calling someone a rock is normally not a compliment. A few different inferences you could make from it. But David means this as a high compliment. And I think what David is getting at here is if you look at verse 2, he's understanding the Lord is the rock, the fortress, the refuge. Really, as you look at verse 2, verse 32, and verse 47, here's what David is saying. God is immovable. God's immovable. Now, as you just think very briefly through the life of David, David is almost constantly on the run. He's running from Saul. He's running from Absalom. He's always on the run. He does establish a kingdom, of course, in Zion. But in the times of David's life, when he's on the run, what's his constant? What's his refuge? What's his safe place? The Lord. What David is saying is this: no matter where my feet may go, no matter where life may take me, God is my refuge. God is my rock. God is the sturdy foundation of my life. When everything else around me is changing, God is immovable. God is constant. As you look, though, at the life of his son Solomon, Solomon is going to build a house on a rock. Go with me to 2 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles chapter 3. So this imagery of God being the rock really goes back to the writings of David. David uses this actually quite a bit in his Psalms. He references God as rock. And to my knowledge, every time that he references God as rock, it means that God is sturdy. God is immovable. God is unshakable. God is constant. Nothing is going to harm that rock. Let's notice what his son Solomon does. David was not able to build the temple because he had been a man of war. But God had promised your son will build it. 2 Samuel 7. Look at me. 2 Chronicles chapter 3 verse 1. Then Solomon, who by the way was the wisest of men, Solomon began to build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah, where the Lord had appeared to David his father at the place that David had appointed, on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. He began to build it in the second of the month of the fourth year of his reign. Do you notice what Solomon does? Solomon, who is contracted by God to build God a house, where does God say, build my house? Where does God say to build it? Build it by the seashore? Of course not. The sands will change. Build it down in the valley where the rains will come? No. God says, build my house on the rock. David lived about 1000 BC. 3000 years later, we still have Mount Moriah. This rock, this mount, has stood the test of time. Now, if you notice where Solomon builds the temple, he builds it in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah. Now, if you think back through the Old Testament, we see Mount Moriah a few times, but there's two very important stories of the Old Testament where Mount Moriah was. The first was in Genesis chapter 22. When Abraham took his son Isaac, and God said, take your son and sacrifice him. Abraham took Isaac to Mount Moriah. God then offered a scapegoat for him, or a ram. And then from there, God then said, no, don't offer Isaac. I will give the sacrifice. Genesis 22 in the life of Abraham, by the way, is the pinnacle of his life of faith. As you look at Abraham's life before Genesis 22, he was a flawed man. He lied. It seems that he had difficult sexual practices. He had unethical work standards at times. He had family issues. Abraham was a very far from perfect man. He was flawed. But when you get to Genesis chapter 22, this is the perfect exemplar of faith in the life of Abraham. And what you see at the end of chapter 22 is the renewal of the covenant that God had made with Abraham in chapter 12, chapter 15, renewed in chapter 17. God renews this covenant, and this is really where you see the immovable bond, the eternal covenant formed between Abraham and Yahweh, God. God forms a covenant with Abraham in about 2000 BC, and this is going to be an eternal covenant. We see Mount Moriah in the life of David. If you look at 2 Samuel chapter 24, after David had conducted his census, which was simply an act of pride, God condemns him for it. And then David goes, if you look at the text, we see the name here in verse 1, to Ornan. Or if it's in 2 Samuel 24, Araunah, same name, just different variations of it. After David conducts the census, he goes to this man, Ornan or Araunah, and then builds an altar there, buys the land from him, and builds an altar there that he may make atonement for his sins before God. What you then see in the life of David is Mount Moriah again symbolizes the covenant between God and man. So why then did God choose Mount Moriah to build his house? Why did God choose Mount Moriah to build his house? I don't think it was because of the climate. I don't think it was because of weather. I don't think it was because of trade routes. Why did God build his house on Mount Moriah? Yes, it's a solid mountain, But throughout the world, there's hundreds of other mountains. Why did the creator of the world choose one mountain, one rock, upon which to build his house? Because out of all mountains in the world, this is the one that most fully symbolizes the eternal covenant between God and man. The covenant between God and Abraham, Genesis 12. The eternal covenant repeated to David in 2 Samuel 7. God made an eternal covenant with Abraham, an eternal covenant with David. He makes a law with Moses. He gives promises to Jacob, promises to Judah, warnings through his prophets. But it's really only through David and Abraham that God made eternal covenants. The reason that God chose Mount Moriah is this is symbolizing the eternal covenant between God and man. And so Solomon builds the house of God on Mount Moriah because this is fully symbolizing the relationship, the fellowship, the untouchable bond between man and God. So let's go back to Matthew chapter 7. Matthew chapter 7. It's in the bulletin, so I'm not going to take the time to read it this morning, but I love Psalm 127. This is written by Solomon, I think, after he builds the house of the Lord. What house shall succeed except when the Lord prepares it? That's what the psalm is saying. What Solomon is saying in the psalm is this: God has to build the house. God had specified where he wanted the temple built. God had specified the exact rock where he wanted it. God has to be the one to build the house, or those who labor, labor in vain. So back in Matthew chapter 7. Everyone who hears these words of mine, verse 24, and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. So before we continue, let's stop here. What did Solomon do? Solomon built his house on the rock. Solomon built his house on the rock. And yes, the temple of Solomon was destroyed. 586 BC, the most tragic year, perhaps with the exception of 33 AD. 586 BC is the most tragic year of the entirety of world history, because that is where God has to ransack his own house. They returned during the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, and Zerubbabel is the one who builds the temple. It was done by the time Ezra returns. Zerubbabel rebuilds the temple. That temple's ransacked in 70 AD. No longer does the temple of Solomon, no longer does the temple of Zerubbabel, and nor do the refurbishments of Herod the Great stand today. But that mount is still there. That rock is still there. The eternal covenant that it symbolizes is still there. So what then does it mean in practice for us to build our house on the rock? Well, we're going to learn from Solomon here. But do you notice the actual analogy here? Jesus, first of all, does not say this. Everyone who stakes his allegiance to me will be like a house on a rock. I think that's the way this is normally interpreted. Everyone who puts faith in me will be like a house on a rock. Everyone who claims allegiance to me will be like a house on a rock. That's not what he says. He says, verse 24, everyone who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came down, and the winds blew and beat the house, but it did not fall because it had been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built a house on the sand. What then is Jesus really getting at in this teaching? What he's getting at is obedience. at action, at life. Be turning with me to James chapter 1. James chapter 1. James, the brother of Jesus, is, I think, going to draw from this sermon in his own epistle. Let's go to James chapter 1. But before I continue, let me make this point. Matthew chapter 7, faith is not that foundation. It's a prerequisite, of course. But what Jesus is really getting at is obedience, is doing, is following the words of Jesus. Now, in the context of the sermon, the reason he says this is his end. This is his conclusion. I think every sermon I've given some form of an invitation. This is not the invitation, so don't do it. But come forward while we stand and sing, right? This is Jesus' way of saying, come forward while we stand and sing. This is his call to action. What he's saying is, I have spoken to you many things. I've given you the Beatitudes. I have given you love. I have taught you true prayer. I have taught you true allegiance. I've taught you true sacrifice. I've taught you true relationships. But now here's what you got to do. Go and do them. And in so doing, you will be like a rock, a house that is built on God, a house that is unshakable and immovable, formed after the eternal covenant of God. James 1 with me. James chapter 1, let's begin in verse 19. James 1 verse 19. Know this, my beloved brethren. Let every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger. For the anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God. Therefore, put away all filthiness and rampant wickedness, and receive with meekness the implanted word, which is able to save yourselves. But be doers of the word. He who hears these words of mine and does them. Matthew 7. But be doers of the word. But be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like a man who looks intently at his natural face in a mirror. For he looks at himself and goes away and at once forgets what he was like. But the one who looks into the perfect law, the law of liberty, and perseveres, being no hearer who forgets but a doer of the work, he will be blessed in what he does. If anyone thinks himself to be religious and does not bridle his tongue but deceives his own heart, this man's religion is worthless. Religion that is pure and undefiled before our God and Father is this: to visit the orphans and widows in their affliction, and to keep oneself unstained from the world. Do you notice all the echoes of Matthew 7 and James 1? Here's what he's saying. Doers are blessed in perseverance. This is his point. Doers are blessed in perseverance. Now, let's go back to Solomon for a moment. Do you remember what Samuel had warned David of? What he had warned the people of? 1 Samuel 12, Samuel makes a strong proclamation to Israel. Submit to God, things will go great. What does David tell his son Solomon in 1 Chronicles 28? Do the word and it's going to go great for you. As you go through the life of Solomon, what happens? When he's obedient and faithful to God's eternal covenant, he's blessed beyond measure. But when he begins following the sins of his father and even supersedes them, then his life goes into immortal array. What happened with Solomon? When he heard the words of the book of the law of Moses and did them, he persevered in doing right. But when he turned from God's word and did wrong, he was cursed in what he did. Now, I do not think Matthew 7 is giving a promise of material blessing, nor do I think it's giving a promise of health and life. I think what it's doing is it's giving a spiritual promise. If you hear God's word and do it, you can enter into eternal covenant with God. you can be founded on that rock that has never been moved. Do God's word and be blessed. This is what James says in verse 12. He says in James chapter 1, verse 12, blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial. For when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life, which God has promised to those who love him. Said another way, blessed is the man who hears the word and does it. For when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life, which God has promised to those who love him. So in practice, brethren, what must we do? We must not only be hearers of the word, but doers of the word. I would urge you, I would love to take the time to do so this morning. Read through Matthew 5 through 7. Read through that whole sermon. It is the most challenging teaching in the history of the world. It teaches humility. It teaches self-sacrifice. It teaches moral strength. It teaches conviction. It teaches love. It teaches mercy. It teaches godly prayer. It teaches the opposite of arrogance and jealousy and bitterness and pride and every other sin that so easily entangles us. What Jesus is saying is this: do not just listen to what I've said, but do it. And when you do it, you will be grounded on the rock. You will be built on the Lord. And your life will not be moved by Satan nor force, Romans 8. But it will be grounded and firm. The sermon this morning was inspired by an email Jane had sent me a few weeks ago. And what the email reminded me of was this: storms come in every single life, period. They may not have come in the last hour, but storms are coming, and storms have already been. At times, we may just be in the eye of the hurricane. You'd better do the word of the Lord in times of peace, because when the storms come is when you're really tested. In times of comfort, times of ease, times of leisure, this is when we must be planted in the Word. This is when we must be grounded in it. And do it. Or lest when storm comes, we're shaken and we fall and Satan takes us out of that eternal covenant and we no longer have a house. So, brethren, what is Jesus really teaching us then? Yes, he's teaching us about our foundation. Yes, he's teaching us about our groundwork, but I think he's getting at something else. Drawing from David, drawing from Solomon, drawing from James, this is what I think Jesus is getting at. The wise man does God's will, and pun intended, will endure life's trials. That's what he's saying. It's not just hearing, it's not just saying, but it's doing. The wise man, the truly wise man, does and will endure. Get out your songbooks, please. So what is your life planted on? What are you built on? What are you grounded in? Solomon built his house on Mount Moriah, symbolizing eternal covenant. Jesus tells us, build your life on my word. Build your life on obedience to my word. Build your life on doing my word, and then you will be like a house that is grounded and planted on the rock. What he's getting at is true biblical wisdom. So, this was Jesus' invitation. And my invitation this morning is just going to follow what Jesus said. Everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat the house. But it did not fall because it had not been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a foolish man who, and does not do them, will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rain fell, the floods came, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell, and great was the fall of it. If you need to respond to Jesus' invitation, come forward while we stand and sing.
My sovereign will.